a moral call right here. This is not about politics. This is about morality.
Health emergencies can't wait for us to have some theoretical debate about some better idea that will never, ever come to pass.
Hello, hello, hello. My name is Jillian Mason. Welcome to the Medicare for All podcast, the podcast for everybody who needs health care. I am very excited to be here today because it is one of my favorite seasons. Not autumn, it's too cold. Not spring, too rainy. It is primary season. This is the season when we get to exercise our demons, celebrate our better angels, and clarify what it really means to be a member of a political party and hopefully set us up for the general election. Just to start with a little anecdote from down here in South Texas, we already had our primary and my partner went to the polls, and there was a gentleman in front of him who was trying to vote in both the Democratic and the Republican primary. And my partner was like, and he got really frustrated. And the man was just explaining to the guy at the polls. He said, "Listen, I just, you know, I think the guy on the Republican side is good. I think the guy on the Democrat side is good. I we should be allowed to vote in both so that we can just get the best candidates for the general election," which is, obviously super problematic, but also really fucking wholesome. And I really want to go into the final months of primary season with that kind of a wholesome attitude that we're setting ourselves up for the general election with the best possible candidates. And that is why I am joined here today by Abdul El Saeed, who many of you know from his previous appearances on the Medicare for All podcast, as well as other podcasts that are listened to by more than a dozen people. And he is an American doctor. He is a former public health professor, a former government official, and a politician. He served from 2023 to 2025 as the director of the Department of Health, Human, and Veterans Services for Wayne County, Michigan. He wrote A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Our Political Epidemic, and also Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide. He's been endorsed by Rep. Jayapal, Bernie Sanders. He is running for the Democratic nomination in the 2026 federal Senate election to represent Michigan. And finally, he is the father to two beautiful cats, Sox and Yoda. Thank you so much, Abdul, for joining me.
Thank you so much, Jillian. You forgot to mention my two beautiful human daughters as well. So we got Sox and Yoda and Emily and Sirin. I think they generally fight for primacy on our stage, but most of the time they enjoy each other's company more than they enjoy ours. So, but yes, no, I'm grateful to be with you. I'm grateful that you're hosting this podcast, and always, always grateful to talk about Medicare for All.
Fantastic. Love it. So for people who may not know you, or for people who need to know you better, and don't we all need to know you better, Abdul? Tell us a little bit about your story. We always want to hear, like, what are the personal things that really motivated you to become a doctor and then to get called to public service in a very different way?
Yeah, Jillian, I'm you read a bio, but the most important thing about me is that I'm my grandmother's grandson. She was the wisest, most intelligent person I ever met in my life. Never got to go to school. She was the ninth of 14, born and raised in a time and a place in Alexandria, Egypt, where girls like her didn't get to go to school. And she herself raised six kids of eight to whom she gave birth. Now, I'd spent a lot of my childhood summers in Egypt hanging out with her. And the thing that she'd always remind me is that the one thing I had over my cousins was not intelligence. It wasn't looks and height and athleticism or anything. It was that I had opportunities. I got to go home to the United States at the end of the summer. And in those 15 hours it would take me to go to Egypt, I would cross a chasm of life expectancy of 10 years. And that was personal. Aunt and an uncle I never got to meet who died before their first birthdays to my grandmother. The crazy thing about it, though, is I didn't have to go 15 hours. I could go 15 minutes from where I grew up in Oakland County, just outside the city of Detroit. I could go 15 minutes south to the city of Detroit. I go 15 minutes north the city of Pontiac, and I would cross the same 10-year life expectancy chasm in my same state, frankly, only traveling city and county lines. That to me was an abomination. It shouldn't matter the color of your skin or what your parents did for work. You should be able to have access to a long, healthy life in the richest, most powerful country in the world. So I became a doctor to try and do something about that. And I realized during my training that too often the reason why people didn't get access to good healthcare, the reason why they stayed sick, was circumstances that had less to do with what was happening in their bodies and more to do with what was happening in their communities. Air they breathe, the water they drink, whether or not they get to see a doctor if they get sick in the first place. And so I made an odd decision to go into public health. I did not want to work in a system that was more interested in rewarding insurance companies and pharmaceutical CEOs than it was in taking care of people who are sick. And so I've been working to try and reform that system ever since, so that every doctor graduating from medical school, more importantly, every patient walking into a clinic or a hospital, can get the healthcare they deserve and know that they're working in a system that really is about providing healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that what you say particular about that, like, just crossing through, crossing across space and also crossing through time, right? and through, these major, disparities is just wild. What do you think it is about healthcare in particular that like grabbed you and made you think that that was, the way, right? I think a lot of us end up getting into this kind of work because we get sick, or because we have a loved one who gets sick or something like that. But you got into this on the caring end of it. And I just think that that's interesting.
Yeah, well, part of it was just hearing about my dad's experiences watching his siblings pass away. Part of it was that my grandmother really wanted my dad to be a doctor, and he always hated the sight of blood. So, she impressed upon me that I ought to be a doctor. But most of it was I just fell in love with people. I love people. I love hearing their stories. I love the gift that they give you of bringing you an experience they might not share it with anyone else, with the idea that you could help them. And I love science. I've always loved the ability to ask a big question that unlocks opportunities in the world. And, medicine for me was that place where people and science intersected in this beautiful kind of way. And then there's the other part of it, which is economics, right? And too often in our society, the economics win. So you've got that beauty of that intersection between people and the opportunity to give them purpose in their pain. And then you've got the science that helps unlock it. And then you've got the economics that keeps us from being able to provide those very same people the things that they need on the other side of science. And I realized, even though, I started my career wanting to focus on that place where people and science interact, I've come to realize that maybe to unlock that for other people, we got to be focused on the public policy and the economics that unlock it for everybody. And that's how I got into it. But I just remember learning how a cell works for the first time. I remember learning how, a liver works, and thinking, man, that's so incredible. Like this beautiful functioning machine that empowers us to do so much that we know about how the body works, but so much we actually don't know about how the body works. I think, it's one of those things where the more you learn, the more you realize we don't know. And, I just think that we at our best as a species have this incredible capacity for inquiry to solve human problems. And medicine sits at the heart of that. But what keeps us from being able to do that is the greed that too often locks away those incredible insights and that process from too many people. And we're seeing the worst of that under RFK Jr., under what Donald Trump is doing to try and rip away healthcare from too many people. And to me, the work to finally guarantee healthcare through Medicare for All is about empowering that gift of science working in the public interest for everybody.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it occurs to me that right now, like as a physician, looking at like RFK Jr. in particular, must feel bad.
Well, it's just, you spend so much time learning and relearning and relearning again. You watch all of your colleagues, just bust their ass, burn the candle on both ends, learning how to do this thing, learning insights, disciplining themselves to the truth, right?
Yeah.
And then you see this complete charlatan who is the epitome of the worst things. Talk about a Nepo baby, man. Like the guy wouldn't be anywhere if his name wasn't Kennedy.
Yeah.
And then just pretending to be something he's not, right? Also, I just find it personally offensive that he works out in jeans. Like, what the fuck? Like, really? I mean, part of me is just like, bro, aren't you chafing all the time?
Like, oh my God, that's
when
just
you start
human.
Sweating in your jeans and you're trying to like, I'm just, and then like it, that to me is like the perfect exemplar of like, you're just not a serious person. You're just not serious about anything you do. And we all have to suffer the consequences. Like the thing about him is that he's usually right about the problems, but he's so goddamn wrong about the solutions. And the thing about it though, is that like, you know, you watch him do what he does and I'm like, yes, I agree that our food space is corrupted by big corporations. So why don't you start regulating big ag and big food? No, instead you're telling us to eat beef tallow, which is not based in any sort of scientific rigorous evidence.
It isn't.
You know, you're talking about like, you know, you're talking about, yes, you want us to be more healthy. So if you wanted people to get more physical activity, maybe instead of, you know, just doing these like hype videos of you working out in jeans, shirtless, on like God knows how high dose of straight up testosterone, you know, maybe instead you would be working to, you know, empower people to actually live a healthy, balanced life because they can work one job and make ends meet because they've got access to physical activity opportunities because we're revitalizing parks in communities and neighborhoods. But no, instead you're just like, look, take as much tea as I do and you can go work out in jeans like I do and eat beef tallow and drink raw milk because somehow that's good. And now we have spikes in measles. So, you know, it is so frustrating because it's just so unserious. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just so unserious.
No, yeah. I mean, absolutely. You know, like I think about him and I think about like the brain worm, right? Like so much of this would be a tribute to the brain worm. And then I realized at some point, I think, probably doing research for this show, he never had a brain worm. He claimed to have a brain worm because he wanted to argue that his wife should get less in alimony during a divorce case. He said, I have a brain worm and therefore I'm not going to earn as much money in the future. And therefore you should be paying me less alimony. And so I should be paying you less alimony. And so, you know, this again, fundamental unseriousness, the man diagnosed himself with the brain worm, you know, like that's insane.
You know, at this point though, like I actually kind of believe him. I don't know. Like I wasn't there.
Okay, that's
didn't
viable.
Eat the worm.
Yeah.
Haven't seen the scans. I just, you know, at some point, like I'd love to just be able to attribute all the insanity to the brain worm. And at the same time, like that worm's doing a lot of work. Like even if that worm is real, like doing a lot of work to justify a complete breakdown in American public health policy and healthcare policy. You know, just FYI, like beef tallow is not going to make you healthier. Right.
No, that's really important. That's an important message. Yeah. And not to dwell on RFK too much, and I want to get to a bunch of other really important questions. But one thing that you said that really strikes me, because especially you're talking about like a love of science, which is something that I love too. You know, you have a person like RFK who, as you said, gets the question right, but never gets the answer right. Right. And so I wonder what you make of that, right? Like there are so many of these folks, particularly in the MAGA movement, who are sensing what many Americans know, which is that there's something really wrong, right? And that working class people aren't doing so great in this country, right? Of course, they have the wrong solutions, right? They think that it's the problem is undocumented people. The problem is Iran or Venezuela or Greenland. I don't even know anymore, right? But so you've got all these problems who are people who are able to identify the problems, but not the solution. And that to me seems really, really dangerous because they're meeting people where they're at, right? But at the same time, they're not taking them anywhere good.
Yeah. And I'll be honest with you. I think it's because we as a society have failed too many people and people are trying to take matters into their own hands because they feel like our system is set to fail them because of the fundamental greed in the system. I'll tell you about a conversation I had at the height of the COVID pandemic as I was talking about the importance of these vaccines and trying to explain how it was that we were able to devise a vaccine in less than a year for a virus that didn't exist, you know, a year ago. And there was this gentleman who said, you know, Abdul, I'm gonna take the vaccine. I trust you, right? Because I've been seeing you around. You've been working in this space for a long time and I trust you. But here's the crazy thing about it. You all are working so hard to try and get me to take a medication that didn't exist a year ago for a disease I don't even have that didn't exist a year ago. And I can't afford my insulin, which is a medication that's existed for 100 years for a disease I've had my whole life.
Yep.
So why is it that you're so focused on this one, but haven't been around when it comes to me getting my insulin? And I looked at him, I said, you know, you're absolutely right. You are absolutely right. And when you feel like the foundational ethic of our healthcare system is to figure out how to make money off of you, then you are going to decide to try and sidestep that system. And that's just basic logic. And we've got to rebuild the system so that the foundational ethic of our system is that we take care of you when you're sick, not we make money off of you when you get sick. And that's why, as a public health guy, I am so passionate about Medicare for All, because it is the solution that would change the ethic of our system. It would answer the question for that gentleman that he deserves an answer to. Yes, you should have your insulin. You should have it for free. You shouldn't have to worry about whether or not you can afford this medication that was sold. Its patent was sold for $1 100 years ago because the guy who discovered it understood how critical this was for people like you.
Yeah,
I want to be able to answer, yep, we get it. Absolutely. Yeah. And yes, you should also take this vaccine because it might save your life from a disease that we didn't have a year ago that has evolved and is now killing a lot of people. Like, so we just have to understand the ways in which our corporatized healthcare system has created this incentive structure that people like RFK Jr. are now exploiting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, I mean, you know, obviously, this is nothing new, right? The kind of situation that we're in right now, the healthcare system has been, you know, plunging deeper and deeper and deeper into crisis. Every year we announce that there's a new healthcare crisis, right? But it's really the same ongoing crisis that just gets worse and worse and worse. So let's talk about this moment, all right? You know, why is this in particular such an important moment? I've been hearing this from candidates all over the country, that this is the moment that we need to we need to have bold progressives running for office, and especially people who are interested in healthcare. So can you talk a little bit about why this particular race was so important that you felt compelled to run for Senate, which can't be fun or anything? So I imagine you're not doing it for kicks.
I'm not doing it for kicks, but I am doing it because this is an existential moment for all of us. I remember sitting in my office the day that they froze federal funds. Feels like 10 years ago. It's only about a year ago now. And I'm sitting in my office in Wayne County looking at all these programs that have just been frozen from underneath us. WIC, food on the table for moms and babies. Federally qualified health centers, the last line of healthcare for people who can't afford it. Vaccines, all frozen. And I get a notification on my phone that after his long career, our current U.S. senator is not seeking re-election, that there's going to be an open U.S. Senate seat. There has not been a Democratic doctor in the U.S. Senate since 1969.
Shut up.
There has never been a public health official in the U.S. Senate. And given all we've talked about with RFK Jr., I think we could use one of those right now. And then you think about, I know,
is that
it's crazy.
True?
It's true.
Wait, who was our last Democratic doctor in the Senate?
I wasn't alive. I don't know. I think he was from Alaska.
Okay, don't look at me like I was alive, man.
Neither of us were alive. Neither of us were alive, clearly.
Neither of us babies were alive during that time period. That is really interesting. There's never been a public health expert in the Senate.
Never been a public health official, as
Whoa.
Far as we know. Yeah.
Whoa.
So, you know, we probably need one, especially given that we're going to have to rebuild after all that RFK Jr. is destroying.
Yeah.
But then let's also understand where we are as a society right now, right? We keep trying to placate Donald Trump. We keep talking about playing not to lose. But the question for us is, what does it look like to win the after Trump? What does it look like to actually fight for the things that people need and deserve? What does it look like to actually answer the questions that people have been asking about our politics for a long time? How come I can't afford to feed my kids? How come I can't work just a single job and make ends meet? How come healthcare gets more expensive every single year and I still can't afford it even though I'm quote unquote insured? Mm-hmm. These are questions that we need to answer if we're serious about winning the future. And I'll be honest with you, I'm sick and tired of watching a bunch of folks who are paid off by the same corporations who created the problem tell us that somehow they are the solution. They are not. It's not enough to hold a seat if the person holding the seat is not actually going to fix the problems that you want fixed. And so, you know, Donald Trump is not the disease of our politics. He's just the worst symptom. The disease is the system that allows big corporations and billionaires and would-be oligarchs to buy and sell politicians in ways that rig the system against us. And if you are not serious about unrigging the system against us, then you are not serious about governing in this moment. And so we just need to lean forward into the future we want to build, not just to oppose the past.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I always tell people Donald Trump is not a monster. He's a mirror, right? He shows us exactly what's wrong with our society and what we're doing wrong as a country. And yeah, you're absolutely right. That the healthcare issue is a huge part of it. What are some things coming up in the Senate where you think that you might have an opportunity to actually intervene in healthcare policy?
Yeah, well, right now, we all know that because of the big, ugly bill, Medicaid is about to get slashed. Health insurance subsidies through the ACA have already been slashed. People are already feeling the cost of it. We watched as premiums on the private employer-based insurance market went up 15% this year. They're going to price out a lot of other people. They're going to go up again next year. And we have an opportunity in 2028 to elect a president who supports Medicare for all, and we'll get it done. And when I'm in the U.S. Senate starting in 2026, I will be stumping up and down the country in support of Medicare for all. Michigan is the heart of the political universe in 2028. You got to win Michigan in the primary. You got to win Michigan in a general. And if you want to come through Michigan, you're going to have to come through me. And you better be talking about Medicare for all if you want to do that. I think there's an opportunity for us to think beyond this moment, right? It's not just about rebuilding all that RFK Jr. has destroyed, all that Donald Trump has destroyed. Mm-hmm. It is about building the future of what we actually need for the 21st century in a way that keeps people safe and secure, allows them to live their best, healthiest lives. We have a profound opportunity, both in 2026 and in 2028 in these elections, if we're willing to have the courage to actually persuade people. Look, when Donald Trump came down that hideous escalator in 2015, nobody was talking about immigration. And now immigration is the central issue that's allowed him to destroy our foundational rule of law through ICE. So what would happen if we had the courage to actually persuade people about the truth, right? He was able to do all that on falsehoods. Imagine what would happen if we actually stepped up and said, in the richest, most powerful country in the world, rather than sending your tax dollars abroad to drop bombs on other people's hospitals, we could be investing in your ability to walk into one of your own. Imagine what would happen when we make that argument. I've been making that argument across 90 cities now. And you know what? It resonates in communities where most people voted for Donald Trump. They understand that at the end of the day, they're getting a bum deal. They're just looking for somebody who actually wants to do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What do you think where do you think people pinpoint? So folks who voted for Trump, I mean, you've probably seen the meme, right, of the lady who is like, who's being interviewed by the local news at the gas station, and she's talking about how the gas prices are going up or whatever. She's talking about how terrible everything is. And the interviewer says to her, well, how many times did you vote for Trump? And she said, 2 times, and I'm a fucking idiot. So, you know, we got people who are having some buyer's remorse or whatever, but do you think that people who you're talking to are able to connect right now what's happening with Trump with what's happening with their healthcare? Is that, like, are people making that direct connection?
I think they are, but I think it's important for us to connect the dots too.
Yeah.
Right? We are right now engaged in an illegal, unjustifiable war that is spiking your gas prices to kill other people and their kids instead of actually solving your healthcare challenges. And we have to remind people that all the time they're spending over there, all the money that they're spending over there is money that could be used to invest in our own people, in our own access to healthcare, in our own schools, in guaranteeing healthcare to everybody through Medicare for All. Those are choices we're making as a society. So we have to connect the dots. The other thing I want us to understand is that votes are not about the past, they're about the future. We are so focused on litigating the past. We're so focused on trying to get people to apologize for the bad votes that they've made. I'm a lot more interested in making sure that they make a good vote next time. So our job is not to just sit there and indict the past. We know the past is broken. We know Donald Trump is insane, an idiot, an imbecile, and self-interested. He is profiting off of this war that he is now fighting through his absurd, probably illegal crypto scheme. And at the same time, our focus has to be the future. If you don't love all that, we're giving you something you can fall in love with. Our job is to get you to see that our self-interest is tied. You getting healthcare when you walk into the hospital is a critical need that we can offer. So rather than constantly pointing over there, right, we got to be pointing into the future and what we're going to do to build it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this forward-looking kind of philosophy that you have, where we're not just arguing against Trump or trying to regain what we have, but actually trying to move forward. I mean, I'm going to be honest, it seems inconsistent with the policies of the Democratic Party, but I mean, you know, maybe you'll make a change.
I'm trying to change the Democratic Party. Look, at the end of the day, a lot of my frustrations I share about the Democratic Party. Too often, the Democratic Party has we focus on Trump because we're not willing to actually articulate a vision for the future, because too often we're bought off by the same corporations that are creating the problem in the first place. Trump has been a useful foil for us not moving past this corporatized politics. You've got these think tanks like Third Way who want to keep us on the current path, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to talk about a different way forward, one where we are not allowing corporations to choke out our entire economy, where we're actually fighting for the things that we need and deserve. And until we are offering a real alternative to the politics as usual that we have seen, do not be surprised when people like Donald Trump rise up on our political scene. So our job is not just to litigate the past. Our job is to win the future. So look, make no mistake, I am not the Democratic Party's favorite, right? But I am the Democratic voters, frankly, the voters' favorites. Why?
Hey.
Because I just tell it how it is. At the end of the day, like, my job is to speak it and to talk about the problems as I see them. And if you support me and what I'm trying to do, I hope that you'll give me your support. And if you don't, that's okay. I understand. But at the end of the day, I am not willing to toe a party line that has watched us continue to falter and fumble when we have opportunities to beat Trump and Trumpism, but also to beat the kind of politics that created Trump and Trumpism.
Yeah. Yeah. Fuck that. Yeah. Absolutely. Let's move forward. That sounds wonderful. You know, you always, whenever you talk, you always sound like an organizer, which I love, obviously. And I know that, you know, your public health career has entailed a lot of organizing, and you've done a lot of organizing for Medicare for All. I wonder, how is this work that you're doing now, organizing a campaign, how is that different from the kind of organizing that you've done in the past? And are there like skills that you've picked up in your past work that you find in running this campaign, that have become useful to you all of a sudden? Maybe not all of a sudden.
No, organizing is about coalition building to get an outcome. And Dr. Martin Luther King said, if your coalition is not uncomfortable, it's not big enough. So you're constantly trying to build a community of people who can focus in on the future. You know, you don't hear a lot of Democrats talk like I talk about going and talking to Trump voters and talking about what we are for rather than just what we're against.
Yeah.
So those are some of the same skills. And at the end of the day, for me, I'm not just organizing to win a Senate seat. I'm organizing to win the future for Medicare for All. I'm organizing to win the future to take out corporate dominance of our politics. I'm organizing for a future where we empower unions and we stand with small businesses instead of big corporations. So this campaign doesn't stop the day I get elected. This campaign just gets started. And I use this campaign as an opportunity to remind us what we're actually for, because all of those same campaigning and organizing skills we're going to need to build, frankly, across the country if we're serious about winning this policy and leading the future. And so, you know, I think they're one and the same skills. Obviously, in the course of a campaign, there are other people who are also running for the seat. But honestly, I just don't pay them much mind. Like, this idea that this is a race between folks, it completely sidesteps the voters. This is not about me and other opponents. This is about the voters and about what they want for their future. My job is to learn that. My job is to speak to the things that I think we all ought to need to lead into a future where we can have the things that we all need and deserve. And if we do that, we win an election. And more importantly, we win the kind of legislation and we win the kind of public policy that could empower all of us to have the more secure future that we deserve.
Yeah. This is all very awesome, and I do feel like I have to ask you about healthcare policy, though. So, I mean, obviously, there was a kind of back and forth between you and one of your opponents on the campaign trail about what it is to have Medicare for All, what a public option is, what a private option is, whatever. Can you just sort of cut through some of the bullshit for us for a second and just like, what was that about? You know, what happened? Has your position on Medicare for All changed? What's going on? Yeah. Tell me what's going on, Abdul.
I ran on Medicare for All in 2018, a state-level single-payer program. I wrote a book on Medicare for All in 2021. I'm running on Medicare for All now. I testified in support of Medicare for All at the U.S. Senate. You know, it's interesting. I don't think we should be taking definitions of Medicare for All from people who famously oppose Medicare for All. And I think too often we have forgotten what Medicare for All actually is. So I want you to imagine what would happen if anybody, you could look inside your wallet and you have a Medicare card, regardless of what age you are, that was there the day you were born, that will not expire until you expire, hopefully after a long, healthy life at 120 years old in your sleep. That card costs you nothing. It costs you nothing at the point of care, and it's good anywhere you seek healthcare. That's Medicare for All. The question at hand is whether or not folks can have additional coverage through their employer or their union. But remember what I said. If your coalition is not uncomfortable, it's not big enough. And as I've been organizing for Medicare for All, I hear from a lot of folks who have been told by the people who oppose Medicare for All what it'll take away from them. They'll say, well, my union organized really hard to get me healthcare and at least I can rely on that. So why do you want to take it away? And I said, I don't want to take it away. I want you to have the safety and security of having Medicare for All. So Medicare for All is not about what it takes away. As much as the opponents of Medicare for All, the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies who buy them off, want to tell you it is. Medicare for All is what the security gives you. I have been for Medicare for All from the jump. I will always be for Medicare for All. That is what I will support. But I don't want us to get twisted by people who are opposing Medicare for All and trying to define it by what it supposedly takes away instead of what it offers you. So I've been for it. I'll continue to be for it. And you know, the people who try to muddy the waters, they're muddying the waters because they understand how popular Medicare for All is. And it's always funny because I look at it and like, all right, so where's your plan? And they conveniently don't have one.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I want to dig into this a little bit more. So for those of you who are listening, who like the fact that we never talk about policy on this show, you can just fast forward a few minutes. This idea, though, that that we should have some kind of private insurance component involved in Medicare for All, that does feel like a shift, right?
Let me correct that. It's not that we should. It's that if people want to, they can. And it's not a shift. I wrote about this both in 2021 and in 2018 when I ran. It's exactly what I articulated for Michigan.
Yeah.
That it wouldn't take anything away from you. If you want to keep additional coverage above and beyond Medicare, under Medicare for All, okay. I'm not interested in taking things away. So that's what I ran on in 2018. That's what I wrote about in 2021. That's what I'm running on in 2026.
Yeah. Okay. And then, and so what are some things, just this is the last policy part. So what are some things that you think, you know, we're talking about Medicare for All. And when we talk about the Medicare for All bill, as it's written now in Congress, it's so comprehensive, right? It includes, you know, vision, dental, you know, mental health, all the parts of your body that the insurance industry wants to claim are not attached to you. So all of that stuff would be included in Medicare for All. Why do you think, you know, why would people want wraparound workplace coverage when they had those kind of benefits?
I don't know. And that's not for me to decide. I mean, frankly, to be honest, like, I am no apologist for the health insurance industry. I've never taken their money and I never will. Their choice about what they want to offer after Medicare for All passes is their choice. But at the end of the day, I'm almost certain that if people have the guaranteed coverage, it's comprehensive for Medicare as you and I define it, they're probably going to choose just to have it. But if they want to choose a private option above and beyond Medicare, I'm not going to say that you can't. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
At the end of the day, there's no reason why you need to have it. And I think most people who are looking at this economic situation are saying, wait, you're telling me that you're giving me all of this for free. Why do I need that other one? I'd be like, I don't know. I'm just not going to tell you you can't. See what I'm saying? Like, that's the thing that I think people don't really quite appreciate. Like, what I am advocating for is guaranteed healthcare that is comprehensive through Medicare for All. If somebody wants to have something above and beyond that, okay. But I just don't know why you would, right? And the health insurance companies are going to have to decide what they want to offer and how they want to offer it. That is their choice. And if they want to work something out with an employer or they want to work something out with a union to offer something above and beyond, fine, right? But I want to make Medicare so comprehensive and so good that at the end of the day, nobody is making that choice, even if I want to keep that choice for them.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. I still have many questions about that. But I think that, you know, one of the things that we do in elections, right, is we choose who we want to fight with more. So I can't wait to continue this discussion with you when you are a senator. That is wonderful. And I think that you're right, right? That we need to be in coalition with people with whom we broadly share values, right? That's what being in a coalition is about. And I know that we all share the value of universal healthcare. And
Jillian, I'll tell you something, right? I spent a lot of time fighting for this policy. And we are living in a time of deep insecurity. In fact, the first book I ever wrote was called Healing Politics, about an epidemic of insecurity. And people are used to losing things. And so they get really triggered when you tell them what you want to take away. And I think we've made a mistake as a coalition for Medicare for All because we've allowed people to talk about what we're going to take away. At the end of the day, I'm interested in talking about what I want to provide.
Yeah.
And so if this question is one of, well, do we want to give the opposition, the insurance industry, big pharma and all of them, this talking point about things that are going to be taken away in a way that fearmongers already traumatized people about what they might lose? Or do we want to just say, okay, we're focused on offering comprehensive, guaranteed healthcare to everybody, right? And you all can talk about what we're going to take away, but we're not taking anything away.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to provide something so good that people will choose it. See what I mean?
Yeah, and this strikes
me. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that this strikes me as good advice for the Medicare for All movement, regardless of how you want to see it structured policy-wise, right? That we need to be actually, you know, we need to be talking about what we're actually providing, what we're offering. That strikes me as very wise advice. But I interrupted you. I apologize.
No, I think we're agreeing on that point. I just think as a matter of politics, like our coalition right now for Medicare for All is not big enough because we haven't passed it yet. So we got to keep growing it. And the question for me is, okay, how do we keep growing it around the central feature of what we're offering? And I want to get this done. If I do nothing else in my life, I want people to have healthcare in this country guaranteed. Nothing. I mean, you don't go to medical school and do a PhD in public health and write a whole book on how to do this and run for office twice on trying to do this because you want anything different. Like I truly, in my heart of hearts, if I do nothing else, I hope that by the end of my life in public service, people have guaranteed healthcare. If I do nothing else, that will give me peace of mind as I go and meet my maker. So, you know, the question for me is like, how do we get it done? How do we build a big enough movement? How do we continue to drive forward? How do we craft the argument that will get people past a fear that they've been told they ought to have to a hope that we need them to have? That is my question, right? And that's been my question in public policy. It's been my question in politics. It's been my question in public service for a very long time. And I think all of us need to be thinking, like we get too, sometimes too precious about the critique and too precious about the policy rather than saying, you know, public policy happens because we are able to build a coalition of people to get there. And how do we build that coalition? How do we listen to what people are telling us? And we're not giving up on anything, right? Not giving up on anything. But what we are talking about is an opportunity to get past the bad faith arguments that people make about what's going to be lost into the good faith hope about what's going to be given.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that makes a lot of sense. Again, sounding way too optimistic for you to be a real politician, but okay. I'll believe it. I'll believe it.
Look,
for
it's because I'm not a politician. I hope I never am. I am a public servant. I'm a public servant who's a doctor. I want people to have the good things in life. That's the only reason to run. And honestly, if I never get elected, you know, so be it. But I am not going to bend on my beliefs about what we ought to have in order to get elected. And so, you know, this is about trying to advance a set of policies for people. You know, and I think we'll keep moving it.
Yeah, that sounds from your lips to God's ears. I really appreciate you being here today to talk about this. I'm getting the word from your staff that you have another event, and I cannot believe that you made time to come and talk to us at the Little Old Medicare for All podcast. I really appreciate it, Abdul.
No, it was my privilege, and of course, you are the Medicare for All podcast. I mean, I wrote the Medicare for All book, so like, you know, we were not going to get through a campaign without doing this. So I look forward to having a conversation again soon. I'm grateful to you for having me and for leading this conversation, and I'm grateful for your fight.
All right. Thank you. We are grateful for that, for your fight as well, Abdul. So thank you once again to Abdul. Thank you to our podcast team, especially our audio editor, Craig Stanton. And remember to like, subscribe, comment, and share with your friends and your frenemies. This podcast is a project of the Healthcare Now Education Fund, and you can support the pod by going to www.healthcare-now.org and clicking on the donate tab to send us some love. Thank you so much, folks. Stay safe and stay dangerous.